You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, so there's this this goat sitting at the bar, and this guy walks in. It's like a joke. Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Rick Perry is a joke. Here we are, what, a week from the Iowa primaries, and it's really starting to heat up. You got Newt Gingrich saying, no, I'm not gonna pick on anybody. By the way, that guy's an SOB, et cetera, et cetera. We'll get into that. But this has got to be the most hysterical line of the entire campaign. Rick Perry, who on, you know, various days of the week doesn't seem to know that Texas is part of the United States. I mean, maybe we should secede, you know. Rick Perry, actually, this is from the New York Times. Rick Perry said, and this, by the way, was the big applause line for the Republicans in the audience, which speaks to the Republicans in the audience as much as it does to Rick Perry. Rick Perry said about the, you know, are getting oil from Canada, from the tar sands up there in Canada. Apparently nobody has told him Canada's a different country. They even have a different currency. They have the loonie up there, the Canadian dollar. We've got the U.S. dollar. They're different. They all have national health insurance, Rick. I'll bet he doesn't know that. You have 54% of their GDP, GDP is government spending. Ours is around 20%, or it's around 30%. They got big government up there, Rick. And they don't have an empire. In any case, Rick Perry says to the crowd, the New York Times says this is one of his speeches that particularly perked up the crowd. Their phrase, perked up. He says, every barrel of oil that comes out of those sands in Canada is a barrel of oil that we don't have to buy from a foreign source. Everybody applauds. They all go, oh, isn't that great? We can buy oil from Canada. We don't have to buy it from any damn foreigners. And then he really nails it in. He says, you know, it's not good policy. It's not good politics. And frankly, it's un-American to be buying oil from foreign countries. So we need to build that pipeline down to Texas so we can take that Canadian sludge and refine it in Texas and ship it to Asia and South America and Central America. You know, this oil is not planned for U.S. consumption. If it was, they'd be building the refinery in Montana right across the Canadian border. For that matter, the Canadians could build a refinery in Saskatoon or something, you know, in Saskatchewan, and just sell us the gasoline. Just, you know, run some tanker trucks over the border or a little teeny tiny short pipeline. But no, they originally wanted to get that oil largely to China, but to other Asian countries as well that are looking to buy oil. They originally were going to do it by running a pipeline west across Canada. This private for-profit corporation, multinational corporation called TransCanada, that owns the rights to the oil that is in that shale, that has to be extracted from that shale, a process that uses mind-boggling amounts of water and energy. And when they first came to and to get it from Saskatchewan to the Pacific Ocean, they had to go through British Columbia, and the government of British Columbia, I mean, it's a province. They have certain sovereign rights and powers, just like states do here in the United States. They said, no, don't think we want that happening. You know, we have these northern rainforests here in British Columbia. And we don't want them ruined by your oil pipeline. And we got animals that migrate. Did you see this article the other day that one of the black bears in the American Southwest is at danger of not total extinction, but you know, major loss of becoming an endangered species. At least that particular local genetic group, because of the fence, because they have to migrate north and south with the climates and things, you know, to hibernate or whatever they do. And the fence is there now, and they can't migrate. We've known for years that the cheetah was going to cause that problem. So it was going to cause that problem for the cheetah and some of the other, you know, high predators that have large ranges that include what we call the United States and what they call Mexico, that used to all just be like, you know, the land. So anyhow, British Columbia said, no, you can't run it through our province. So they said, okay, cool, we'll run it across 1,000 miles of the United States. And maybe we'll get the Koch brothers or BP or somebody to build a refinery down in Texas or use one of the existing ones. So that all the fumes and the carcinogens and poisons and stuff that come out of the refining process go up into the air there in Texas and downwind to Mississippi and Alabama and Louisiana, where they're already getting that stuff. They've already got cancer alleys. A lot of the people who live down there anyway, they're just, you know, largely minorities and poor, so no big deal. Right, this is the strategy. And then Rick Perry comes out and says, for every barrel of oil that comes out of those sands in Canada, it's a barrel of oil that we don't have to buy from a foreign source. Yay, Rick! Yay! This is hysterical. You know, yesterday I was talking about the TSA and our experience, Louise, my experience saying no to the Chertoff porno x-ray scanners. I can't tell you how. I mean, the long threads and the comments on our message board and the voicemails that we've gotten and some of the horror stories and strange stories and you know, very interesting stories. But a couple of things, two comments that I wanted to pass along with you that just made such perfect sense. I have been arguing for some time that the Chertoff x-ray porno scanners serve two purposes. The first purpose is to make millions of dollars for Michael Chertoff and his buddies in the military, defense, police state industrial complex, which is growing like a weed. And the second purpose is to acclimate Americans to being considered guilty and having to prove their innocence, which is the reverse of what the Fourth Amendment in the Constitution says, and behave like sheep when confronted by authority figures in uniform. And ironically enough, the people on the right agree with me on certainly the second and probably the first. And one person sent me a note saying, I live in Israel. We have a dozen countries around us who have declared not just that they don't like us, but that they intend to kill every last one of us. And they've killed a bunch of us. We have the most dangerous air travel in the world, in theory. Because all these people want to kill us. We don't use the Chertoff x-ray scanners. Because we know that people can hide explosives in body cavities and they would never be found. That was the first one. The second one was somebody sent me a note saying, why does our government think that stopping one person with 3 ounces of liquid isn't going to stop 10 people with 30 ounces?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's like what? They can't get a quorum? Up next, John Nichols checking in from Occupy Iowa. Did you know the Republicans have an undisclosed location now? Welcome back to Occupy the Airwaves, also known as the Tom Hartman Program. John Nichols on the line with us, the Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine, thenation.com, where he's writing. Hey, John.
Hey, man, that sounded like radio.
Yeah, I guess so. How you doing today?
I'm great, brother. It was great being last night with you.
Yeah, thank you. Occupy activists are meeting in Iowa planning caucus events. Tell us about this.
Well, there's a lot going on. I mean, Occupy, who would have thought that Occupy, you know, actually had started in Zuccotti Park in New York and then kind of grabbed the attention of Iowa more than just about any other state.
Well, here's a question, John.
Yeah.
Are these, you know, Occupy the ballot folks, are they people who are basically political activists who are appropriating the Occupy name, or are they people who were occupying, you know, some town in Iowa and have decided to do this instead?
A little of both.
Okay. Okay.
And so there's actually even a little bit of friendly competition between folks who actually are using some of the same names,
right.
Occupy the caucuses, Occupy Iowa caucuses. Bottom line is this. There are very active, very energetic Occupy Wall Street-inspired movements on the ground in Ames, Iowa City, Cedar Rapids, and especially Des Moines. And these are big things. They're very genuine with a lot of people engaged, a lot of young folks. In addition, in Iowa, to a much greater extent than in a lot of other places, older activists who have been, you know, very much on the left for a long time have embraced the Occupy spirit.
Yeah, it seems to me like it's mostly, you know, those of us old enough to remember the 60s and 70s and young people who are discovering politics.
That's exactly right. In fact, one of the first people arrested at an Occupy event outside New York was Ed Fallon. And Ed Fallon is a longtime former state representative in Iowa and a very strong candidate for governor a few years ago. He got about 25% of the vote in the Democratic primary against Chet Culver. And he was arrested with other Occupy activists when they tried to clear the grounds of the state capitol. He's very much engaged with a lot of outside the caucus activity, organizing people at events to study issues. There's going to be a big event on Friday. Reverend Jesse Jackson is coming in along with representatives of National Nurses United.
That's
to
great.
Talk about, you know, inside-outside strategies.
Yep.
So it's really energetic. It's
okay,
genuine.
Do I have this right? The Republicans are counting the caucus votes in an undisclosed location. Is this so they can keep the Ron Paul votes safe, as in if Ron Paul wins, we'll never know it?
Wink, wink, nod, nod.
Yeah.
I think that there is a danger in playing that game. And it is likely that there will be, you know, a reasonably accurate count of the caucuses. But here's the interesting dynamic. It's on the margins of it that it's going to get really weird. They have announced that, at least in some places, they're not going to send in the uncommitted or no preference votes. These could be very significant numbers of votes that they're just going to throw to the side. There's also, once you get into the caucus room, and I think your listeners, many of them very sophisticated, will know how this works, but perhaps not everyone. When you get in the room for your precinct, you divide up into groups supporting the different candidates or supporting no candidates.
And you stand in different parts of the room.
It's very public, and there's a lot of pressure. And so the big issue is going to be, you know, I think the Paul folks who show up are going to be strong, and they'll hold their own. But it'll be very interesting to see what the pressures are in other directions, perhaps to pull all the evangelicals together behind one candidate.
Yeah.
And this is where, you know, when you start to add the votes up and get them together, there's certainly plenty of room for gaming the process, both physically on the ground and then as you send things in, determining whether somebody got to the proper threshold. It's one of the real problems of caucuses. These are not democratic endeavors.
Who has the strongest personality wins.
Right.
At the local level. I'm not talking about candidates, but I'm talking about the surrogates.
Well, and more than that, Tom, who has the best bladder? It's as simple as that. Because these can be marathon events. And if you walk out of the room, you never know.
Everything changes.
Exactly.
Amazing.
It's a very messy process. And the interesting thing is that the Occupy movement has suggested, I think in a very honorable way, that they want to join into this process. This is Iowa's great political theater. Mm-hmm. And so Occupy folks will show up at Democratic and Republican caucuses. But it's going to be very interesting to see how they're treated.
Wait a minute, are there Democratic caucuses going on?
Of course.
So, and
Barack Obama is running for re-election. There will be Democratic caucuses at every precinct in Iowa. And here's the fascinating thing. Occupy folks and others, there's a healthcare not warfare group that's organizing, saying that instead of voting for President Obama, you should vote for an uncommitted slate.
Wow.
Yeah, that's real. And I think in Iowa City, which is a real strong progressive area, as well potentially as Des Moines and Ames, maybe even Dubuque, you could well see a significant number of votes for uncommitted.
Well, uncommitted has won in several previous elections over the last 30 years. They've won three times, have they not, in one of the other parties?
Uncommitted has done great in Iowa, very early in the year. And so uncommitted beat Jimmy Carter back in 1976.
Right. And basically it's a way of saying, hey, get your act together.
Or let's focus on an uncommitted movement organized in the right way, and this is what the healthcare not warfare folks are talking about. It can say, we want to be involved in this process of choosing delegates throughout the rest of the year and all the way to the convention with an eye toward raising issues, economic, social, or foreign policy issues. So
Right. There's
a lot of ways to intervene.
Remarkable. Well, thanks for the report from the ground, John. It's going to be an interesting time, a very interesting time. Yeah, there you go. John Nichols with The Nation, thenation.com. John, thanks.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So we're back. We're going to be back in just a second. Rick Santorum wants you to stick it to the man. You're not going to believe this one.
Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle.
Yeah, it's the story of the Republican primary. Welcome back, 34 minutes past the hour. On your media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman Program, and it's Rick Perry. With apologies to Pastor Niemöller, and maybe you can help me fill this in. Feel free to give me a call at 866-987-THOM if you have suggestions. Pastor Niemöller was the German minister who famously wrote, first they came for the trade unionists, and I was not a trade unionist, so I did not speak up. I'm paraphrasing. I'm doing this entirely from memory. I'm sorry. So my apologies, my double apologies to the pastor if I have this wrong. And then they came for the communists, and I was not a communist, and so I did not speak up. And then they came for the Jews, and I was not a Jew, and so I did not speak up. And then they came for, and there were maybe one or two others in there. And then finally he said, and then they came for the churchmen, and I was not a churchman, and so I did not. And then they came for the churchmen. And there was no one left to speak up for me. So, Rick Perry has decided that he's going to sue because the state of South Carolina, or Virginia, excuse me, the state of Virginia has said, actually, it started, here's how it started. It used to be the Republicans said, you want to be on the ballot in Virginia, turn in 10,000 signatures. Newt turned in 11,500. He figured he had it in the bag, right? Turn in 10,000 signatures, registered Republicans, everything's cool. We'll take it from there. And then this guy sued. His name is Michael Osborne. And he was an independent. And as an independent, he didn't have a party who got to set the rules for whether or not he could be a candidate on the ballot. And so as an independent, he had to go by the same rules that they use in the actual election, which is that you got to have ID, and it's got to, your address has to be the same on your voter registration as it is on your ID and all that kind of stuff. And so he sued the state, and he said, why is it that the Republicans get to just, take any 10,000 signatures they want and say, see, I got 10,000, and I don't. I've got to get, 15 or 20,000 so that I can, filter out the people who thought that they were registered but aren't, or the people who've moved and forgot to change their registration or whatever. And he won. And the court said, okay, the Republicans and the Democrats both have to start playing by the rules. And Michael Osborne, the same rules that you have to play by. And apparently nobody bothered to tell Rick Perry or Newt Gingrich this. Or their campaigns were unaware of it, or they didn't know. I mean, after all, Newt just lives in Virginia. So Newt's complaining about it. He's saying, this is a broken system. Gee, you think? I mean, it's a terribly broken system. I think anybody in the United States who has a Social Security number should be able to vote. Who's a citizen? Who's a U.S. citizen? Now, in our conference call this morning, in our pre-show meeting, Sean, our producer, Sean Taylor, who's a Canadian citizen, said, you know, I've got a Social Security number. And I said, you know, well, frankly, I don't mind if you vote. Not that I would encourage her to because it's illegal, but I mean, I don't mind if the law was changed. I would rather have, see, anybody with a green card gets a Social Security number because they got to pay taxes. Anybody, you know, legal residents, legal immigrants. And it's a really small number of people relative to the population of America. I would rather see a few people voting who aren't U.S. citizens who probably shouldn't vote than have hundreds of thousands and or millions. I mean, the last estimate is that just the states so far that have passed these ALEC-inspired or ALEC-written laws disenfranchising voters, 5 million people are going to show up thinking they can vote and get turned away at the polls in 2012, next year, next November. 5 million. I would rather have, you know, a couple hundred thousand, you know, and frankly, it's not going to be that. I don't know how many green cards are out there, but it's not like tens of millions or something. And they're not going to vote as a block. And most of them probably aren't going to even vote. But I would rather err on the side of too many people voting than not enough voting. I think one of the biggest problems we have in America is that small, loud, dedicated, committed, very often crazy groups are able to become the rudder that swings the ship of American politics by virtue of the fact that they can show up in a church or they can show up in a, you know, and organize them and get all their people out to vote and change elections. But back to my Pastor Niemöller. So Rick Perry, who also, like Newt Gingrich, got more than 10,000 signatures, but when they verified them, discovered that he didn't have 10,000 verified signatures where the voter ID and the voter address matched. Rick Perry says, in the finest tradition of Texas, where they have tort reform, by the way, I'm going to sue. Now, he's all in favor of tort reform. He's all in favor of if you're injured by, you know, a big corporate, you can't sue. Or if you can, you know, maximum $250,000 if your kid is disabled for life. That's it. But see, he says, I'm going to sue. So we need to come up with a poem for these guys or, a saying. You know, first they disenfranchised the African Americans, but I was not an African American, so I did not speak up. Or, you know, first they disenfranchised the African Americans, but Rick Perry was not an African American, so he did not speak up. Or actually, arguably, since the Constitution specifically excludes not women, not people who don't own land. I mean, there are these popular misconceptions that at the founding of the country, women couldn't vote. People who didn't own land couldn't vote. There were some states where women did vote. There were some states where African Americans voted. There was, and nowhere in the Constitution does it say you have to own land or own property to be a voter. Okay, but setting aside that, the Constitution does specifically exclude Native Americans. So you say first they disenfranchised the Native Americans. They didn't let the Native Americans vote. But Rick Perry was not a Native American, so he did not speak up. Then they disenfranchised the African Americans. But Rick Perry was not an African American, so he did not speak up. Then they disenfranchised the Latinos, but Rick Perry was not a Latino, so he did not speak up. Then they disenfranchised the students, but Rick Perry was not a student, so he did not speak up. Then they disenfranchised the poor, but Rick Perry was not poor, so he did not speak up. Then they disenfranchised the elderly, but Rick Perry was not elderly, so he did not speak up. Then they disenfranchised Newt Gingrich, but Rick Perry hates Newt Gingrich, so he did not speak up. Then they disenfranchised Rick Perry, and there was no one left to speak for Rick Perry but his lawyer. What do you think? Think we got something here? I don't know. It's an interesting one. It's an interesting one. Ben Nelson yesterday, I talked about this briefly yesterday, but I wanted to get into it in a little more detail today. Ben Nelson announced that he's going to retire at the end of the year, or the end of next year, actually. The end of this Senate's session, this congressional session. And, you know, I refer to Ben Nelson as, if ever there was a dino, a Democrat in name only, it's Ben Nelson. I've been, you know, for years talking about that rabid weasel on his head. Yeah, there you go. The thank you, Jacob. That I am convinced has taken control of his brain. Because he keeps, you know, I mean, this is the guy who, like, he's opposed to unemployment insurance. He's opposed to a public option or, God forbid, single payer. He had people arrested for that. He blows up things that progressive Democrats stand for. So here, you know, so he's leaving. Thank God. Baruch Hashem. Praise the Lord. Pass the ammunition. Light the fireworks. Whatever. I mean, fill in your cliche. I shouldn't use ammunition in the same context with a politician. I apologize for that. But you get the point. I'm pleased to see Ben Nelson resigning. But here's the thing. The option that is now facing the Democratic Party in Nebraska, what are you going to do? What are they going to do? Ben Nelson, 12 years ago next year, replaced Bob Kerrey, who was about as exciting as a bucket of lukewarm something. And Bob Kerrey said, hey, I'm available if you want me. And I'm saying, you know, to the Democrats in Nebraska, to the Democratic Party in Nebraska, find somebody like Elizabeth Warren. Find somebody like Sherrod Brown. Find somebody like Bernie Sanders. Find yourself a progressive patriot who can win.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And if you do, you will win. And the Democrats will have a good Democrat in the Senate. It'll be a fine thing.
Better staple it together and call it fair weather. Staple it together and call it fair weather. Staple it together and call it fair weather. Staple it together and call it fair weather.
Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. Don't even think about it. At all. I told you I was going to share with you Rick Santorum's Stick It to the Man. This is incredible. Clip number two, Jacob. Rick Santorum, if ever there was, you know, even, I mean, just look at Rick Santorum, right? You think about, you know, who's the man, right? Mr. Clean Cut, whatever. I mean, not that I'm, you know, a hygiene fetishist or something, but somehow this just seems so odd coming out of Rick Santorum's mouth. Here it is.
If you want to send a message to the man, those are the folks that are, you know, the experts, the folks who try to shape this race. And let me assure you, they have shaped this race. You want to stick it to the folks who think they can shape the debate and tell you who you should pay attention to. This is where you step up and say, no, you don't get to decide. The people get to decide.
Yeah, you want to stick it to the man? Vote for Rick Santorum. Just don't Google his name. Jeez, I wonder if there's a double entendre in there. Rick Santorum, Google his name, stick it to the man? No, that could not have been a Freudian slip on Rick Santorum's part. Could it? Wait a minute. Let me just hear the first 10 seconds of that again, Jacob.
If you want to send a message to the man, those are the folks that are, you know, the experts, the folks who try to shape this race. And let me show you, they have shaped this race.
Okay, so he didn't say stick it to the man. He said if you want to send a message to the man. Do I have that right? There's no place in there where he says stick it to the man?
You want to stick it to the folks who think they can shape the debate and tell you.
Okay, I see. Okay. Yeah, okay. Then in that case, I stand corrected. No, we're not going to creatively edit Rick Santorum. That and Rick Perry. Rick Perry, this has to be the most outrageous. Rick Perry's applause line. This is absolutely incredible. He says his number one applause line for his Republican followers. Now, keep in mind the recent, I think it was a Pew study, a Pew poll. It was a poll by, or study by somebody, you know, some relatively highly respected nonpartisan group that found that people who watch GOP TV, a.k.a. Fox so-called news, actually are more misinformed, more poorly informed, or more uninformed than people who watch no TV news whatsoever. And they make up the base of the Republican electorate. In fact, this is one of the big challenges right now that's going on in Iowa, is this debate between the Fox primary, because Fox is clearly, I mean, they're trying to kick Gingrich up there for a while, but they're basically, I'm not sure that the Fox primary, for a while the Fox primary was pushing Herman Cain, and then they were pushing Rick Santorum, and you know, basically what they're trying to do is drum up ratings. I think they're very ambivalent about Mitt Romney. But on the other hand, they've got to treat him nicely because he might be president. So you know, and Rupert Murdoch has significant business holdings in the United States that could be affected by the president of the United States. So in any case, you've got the Fox News, who will say anybody but Ron Paul. And Fox News has so much influence on the Republican electorate that they basically typically define who the Republican candidates are going to be. And then on the other hand, you got Ron Paul followers who are like just gung-ho. And Rick Perry never got to be one of the Fox News golden-haired boys or girls. He never got to be one of the anointed ones. And well, maybe he did for a little while there. There was a little while there when Rick Perry was doing really well and Fox News, everybody was talking about him and hey, isn't he wonderful? And yeah, he's a great guy. And then he showed up at the debates and couldn't remember three things and stuff like that. So anyhow, Rick Perry, his biggest applause line from the New York Times. The crowd perked up when he said this, according to the New York Times. Every barrel of oil that comes out of those sands in Canada is a barrel of oil that we don't have to buy from a foreign source. Yeah, that's Rick Perry. So, anyhow, Ben Nelson, Rick Perry, Iowa caucuses. There's one last thing that I wanted to share with you. I saw this over at Democratic Underground. It's actually from The Atlantic, and Swag posted it over at DU. And it was just amazing. It's by Connor Friedersdorf in The Atlantic. And it reminds us, back during the Vietnam War, there was this phrase, the war always comes home. And it was about how the war comes home. And the war does come home. A joint base, Lewis McChord, described by the Independent Military newspaper Stars and Stripes last year as the most troubled base in all the military. All of these factors have crystallized in what some see as a community-wide crisis. Local veterans group calls it a base on the brink. In a recent series of community meetings, the group warned that the trauma of multiple deployments has begun to show up in troubling numbers outside the base. The recent reports of suicide, 7 confirmed and 5 under investigation, with a total of 62 since 2002. Parallel those of murders, fights, robberies, domestic violence, drunk driving, and drug overdoses. Local crime wave became apparent as early as 2004 when 3 elite Army Rangers were among a group of 5 men who stormed into the Bank of America in Tacoma armed with AK-47s, took over the branch, and walked out with $54,000. Over the last 2 years, an Iraq veteran pleaded guilty to assault after being accused of waterboarding his 7-year-old foster son in a bathtub. Another was accused of pouring lighter fluid over his wife and setting her on fire. One was charged with torturing his 4-year-old daughter for refusing to say her ABCs. A Stryker Brigade soldier was convicted of the kidnap, torture, rape, or attempted rape of 2 women, one of whom he shocked with cables attached to a car battery. And an Iraq War sergeant was convicted of strangling his wife and hiding her body in a storage bin. And then it goes on from there. The war comes home. We are, you know, war damages people so badly.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you, and oh, we've covered a lot of territory today. From Rick Perry saying you can stick it to the people, send a message to the man, Rick Santorum, to Rick Perry saying that, you know, every gallon of oil that we buy from the Trans-Canada pipeline from Canada is a gallon of oil we don't have to buy from a foreign country. And that being a big applause line in the Republican campaign to, you know, what's going on with Ron Paul and what's going on with the Iowa caucuses. The super PACs are weighing in now, big time. Phil Kirpin is on the line with us. Phil Kirpin, his new book is Democracy Denied. His website, Phil Kirpin, KERPEN.com. Economic policy analyst and advocate, conservative advocate, I should say. Right, Phil?
Free market, Tom.
Free market advocate. Okay, great. That's fine. I'm curious, Phil, to the extent that you might identify yourself with or find affiliation with the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, what do you think, what are your thoughts on how the Republican Party is having to deal with the Ron Paul phenomena growing, the libertarian, not even Ron Paul, but the libertarian movement growing within its ranks?
Well, I mean, I think that this is a, I think this is a reaction to a Republican Party that did not deliver on its professed free market ideals when it controlled everything in Washington. And, you know, this was, I think, one of the clear messages of the 2006 election was that all of the earmarks and all of the corruption and all the big government spending had, sort of disillusioned and disaffected a lot of voters, and I think that Ron Paul has been building a lot of momentum based on that.
But what was the last election when that wasn't the case? I mean, I remember Eisenhower reminding us, or warning us about this in 1961, but it seems like, I mean, you could go back, Ulysses S. Grant was taking bribes, for goodness sakes.
Well, I think the, at a certain level, corruption is endemic in government, but when government is much, much bigger, the sort of stakes, the implications of that corruption become much, much greater as well. And I think that Ron Paul is campaigning on a return to a much smaller government, both domestically and in terms of foreign policy, that would have much less power over our lives and consume much less of our money, and I think that's resonating with a lot of people right now.
Yeah, I don't disagree, actually. I disagree with some of him, with many of the things that he wants to do away with, but I think your analysis is probably right, and it's picking up a lot of young people as well, who don't perhaps really have a good understanding of everything that the government does, should be doing, from my point of view, shouldn't be doing from your point of view, whatever, you know, who don't know. Is Fox News picking the Republican nominee? It's, you know, there's a line of thought that Josh Marshall started back in August of this year with his meme, his theme of the Murdoch primary, and pointing out that Rupert Murdoch in the UK is so pervasive in terms of media. You know, he owns the major television satellite system. He owns the major newspapers, the Times of London, all the Sun, the major tabloids. Used to be News of the World. That he was basically able to pick even Tony Blair, who was kind of a Bill Clinton light, you know, the equivalent of a Democrat. He has picked who's going to run that country for the last 15 years or so or longer. And in the United States, by and large, Fox News is picking the Republican nominees, and they're doing everything they can to take down Ron Paul. Well, I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Well, I think that people tend to overstate the influence of any given media outlet. And for folks like us who are, you know, prodigious consumers of news, it's easy to kind of parse these trends and ascribe more significance to them than they really deserve.
But Phil, every time Fox News highlights
cable news, there aren't that many people who watch cable news.
Well, I get that, but I think that they're, you know, I think was it Thorsten Veblen had the theory, if you can influence the 20% of people in a society who are the influencers, you can influence 100% of the society, and if you can influence the 1 or 3% of the people who are the most influential among the influencers, you can influence the influencers. That when Fox highlighted Rick Perry early on, suddenly Rick Perry shot to the top. When Fox highlighted Herman Cain early on, Herman Cain shot to the top. When Fox decided to highlight Newt Gingrich, for lack of anybody else, he shot to the top. You can actually draw what I think is a correlative line between Fox giving favorable coverage to Republican nominees and those Republican nominees picking up numbers in the polls, and for that matter, to Fox trashing people and those people falling in the polls.
I would suggest that most of the ups and downs we've seen have actually been a consequence of the many, many Republican debates, and some of them were on Fox, but many of them have been on other media outlets, and this is a campaign that's been defined by the debates, overwhelmingly so, and that's what allowed people like Herman Cain and Newt Gingrich to really surge up to the top with very little organization and very little money, and for good or for ill, it's been the debates that have really defined this primary, I think, more than any particular media outlet or the shape of coverage.
You don't think that my theory on this is that Fox News has been incredibly powerful and influential with regard to the Republican primary, but the secret weapon that Ron Paul has that didn't exist a couple of decades ago, I mean, arguably existed in the form of his newsletter, but you know, only minimally influential. The secret weapon that he has is the Internet. He's got bloggers and he's got websites. And he's got things that Fox can't control. They can't play the role of gatekeeper anymore. They can only be a gatekeeper. They can't be the gatekeeper.
Well, I don't think there are any more gatekeepers. And, the left and the right have their sort of media critics who kind of make a full-time career out of, you know, parsing what goes on particular networks and what have you. But you're right. I mean, between talk radio and the Internet, people have direct access to information now, and pretty much every viewpoint is expressed, and people who are looking for information can find it. And so I think that we've got a much more kind of democratized media environment, notwithstanding the concerns from the left about consolidation and so forth. I mean, I think people are able to get just about all the information they want these days, and they'll make their choices based on that.
Well, you know, and to that, we've got this legislation coming along, this SOPA legislation that basically is going to say that, well, in fact, Eric Erickson, you know, a guy on your side, blogging over at Red State, Red Mass, I guess it was, .com, I think it is, the conservative Massachusetts blog, pointed out that both Red Mass and Blue Mass, the Democratic Massachusetts blog, would probably be put out of business by this legislation that is the so-called Protect the IP that is coming along. And it seems like the only guy out there who is, or the only peoples out there who are strongly opposed to this are Ron Wyden on the Democratic side, who is leading a good fight. But, you know, keep in mind, Google is opposed to this. I mean, there's some big bucks on both sides. And Ron and Rand Paul.
Well, Daryl Issa is the House sponsor of the Wyden Issa legislation, which is a...
Okay, so Daryl Issa, too, who totally gives me the creeps.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's that one is not along kind of traditional party lines at all. It's really the major content companies, and there are hundreds of them, have lined up, and they're principally through the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and they want to create a system that would allow them to take down what they see as infringements without proper, you know, without going through proper.
What's your opinion on that, Phil?
I mean, I think it's I think it's a flawed bill. I wouldn't support it in its current form. I mean, I do think that there's a problem with rogue websites that are not respecting intellectual property, and I kind of prefer an international approach, because if you don't get buy-in from the countries that have these websites located in them, I don't really see how you can effectively enforce it.
Yeah, it's true. People will just move their server to Denmark or to Somalia, for that matter. Yeah. I mean, you know, someplace where they don't have to worry about it.
Where they don't have an effective rule of law.
Right, and then you end up going after consumers in the United States. And then you've got a mess where the FBI is coming to your door saying, hey, you downloaded something from a Somali website.
It's a real problem, but this isn't the way to fix it.
Yeah, okay. Interesting. Phil, nice talking with you and not shouting at each other.
Well, we're just chatting about the what
you
it looks
go.
Like for next week.
Happy holidays and happy New Year. Thank
yeah,
you, Phil.
Same to you,
Phil
Tom.
Kirpin, philkirpin.com, economic policy analyst and free market advocate.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with more. That was nice. That was every now. You know, it's I think that as Americans we have more in common than we do as right and left.
Now I know that they get memos, but what to tell you every night. And when the sane watch, they get brainwashed by the rich white bigots on the right. Now I pity the fool that falls for what they do all. Yeah.
Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. And Newt Gingrich, this is clip number 5, Jacob. This is hysterical. Newt Gingrich, I'm not going to go negative. How dare you go negative? By the way, I got some thoughts on Ron Paul. Here he is.
All I'd say, Mitt, is if you want to run a negative campaign and you want to attack people, at least be man enough to own it. You look at Ron Paul's total record of systemic avoidance of reality, and you look at his newsletters, and then you look at his ads. His ads are about as accurate as his newsletters.
Yeah, right. That was not edited. That was actually Newt Gingrich doing a complete 180 backflip within 45 seconds. Dennis in Santa Barbara. Hey, Dennis, what's on your mind today?
Yes, I'm actually calling about the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Fund.
Right.
And I happen to be with Occupy Santa Barbara.
Mm-hmm.
And we have made a statement, and I'd like to read the statement.
I'd rather you generally we don't allow reading on the radio. It puts people to sleep. If you could just tell me what the statement says, that would work much, much better.
Yeah, it just says that all senators and congresspersons swear to take an oath
right.
to uphold the Constitution and the
right.
Bill of Rights.
And defend the Constitution. Right, yeah.
And we are calling for the impeachment of all those who have passed this unconstitutional bill, because including, by the way, the president for letting it go through, because it completely obliterates our Bill of Rights.
Okay.
So,
Dennis, I got it. And I got to tell you, you're a little late to the party, because, you know, George W. Bush was doing this, and Barack Obama. I mean, this bill says indefinite detention. President Obama killed somebody a couple of weeks ago without a trial. I mean, this horse has left the barn. We need to be going back to when George Bush was saying that, you know, the whole world is a battlefield, enemy combatants. I mean, he took Jose Padilla, who was an American citizen, and turned him into a piece of furniture. I mean, according to his attorney, according to Padilla's attorney, he is so brain damaged from the torture that the Bush administration subjected him to, that he literally behaves like a piece of furniture. He sits for hours and stares and can barely answer a coherent sentence. And this is from 8 years ago. So I'd say you're a little late to the party. I don't disagree with your sentiment that this is outrageous. But
it's a total attack on our freedom.
Yes.
And
but it is not the only one. And we need to look at the whole broad thing. By the way, what's Occupy Santa Barbara up to? You guys camping? What's next?
No, the camping thing is for the temporarily. We're getting an injunction against the police for breaking up our camp.
Uh-huh.
So that's temporarily on hold.
Okay.
But we think that we're going to win that. But we are still active. We are having protests every
Great.
Week.
Great.
And right now we are concentrating on this issue because this is our very freedom, and it's very connected. Absolutely. The Obama administration has claimed that they have a right to kill American citizens, that they think they're terrorists, and has
actually
has
did it. actually did it. And that's my point. That's why I said you're just identifying this specific piece of legislation is coming late to the party. We need to be saying in general, all the way back to the Patriot Act, you know, we need to go back to being an America that genuinely is the land of the free and the home of the brave, rather than the land of the observed and the home of the terrified, which is what George Bush and Dick Cheney tried to turn us into. But Dennis, I'm with your sentiment, and good luck. I wish you the very best on it. And so please say hi to everybody at Occupy Wall Street, Santa Barbara or Occupy Santa Barbara for us. Gordon in Carrboro, North Carolina. Hey, Gordon, what's on your mind today?
How you doing? Have you heard about the working families parties in various states?
I have.
They're fusing with Democrats. It's a compromised way for Social Democrat Party to have a say in power.
Yeah, depending on the state. I mean, you know, in New York, you've got fusion voting, so you could vote in one party and be on the ballot. You can have candidates on the ballot in multiple parties, but in most states, you can't.
Yes, but you can have it in South Carolina. They got rid of anti-fusion laws in Oregon and Vermont, and Vermont's trying to pass single-payer health care.
They've already passed it. They're trying to implement it. They've already passed it.
Okay, right, okay, but it's not going to be implemented until 2014, I believe.
That's right, because it requires under Obamacare, it would have been illegal without Obamacare, and under Obamacare, after 2017, actually, I think it is, they will be able to get a waiver from the government so that they can do it. And they're asking the Obama administration, or they're trying to push through legislation, or both, to move that date up to 2014. And right now, Governor Shumlin and the legislature have put together a study committee to try to, you know, they already passed legislation saying we're going to have a Medicare party, we're going to have a single payer system. And the House and Senate agreed on that. The governor campaigned on that and won. The people are behind that. But now the devil's in the details. They have to work out the details. So they've got the study committee that's working on the details, and they figured that by the end of, you know, next year, the year after that, they'll have the details nailed down. They can run that through the legislature so that they get the details into law, and that shouldn't be a problem. And then they need that waiver, and that's the 2014 date.
In Oregon, they're trying to pass a public bank.
Yeah, there's actually, I believe, 14 states right now that have legislation pending. California among them, the largest, that will create, as North Dakota has had since 1918 or 1919, a
Correct.
Public bank, and all the profits from that bank will go into the state treasury. So rather than the profits going to New York City to Wall Street, where the banksters this year are paying themselves a $135 billion bonus and compensation package, that $135 billion, which could send a hell of a lot of kids to school, build a lot of hospitals, do a lot of good, that will go into the state treasuries, and I'm all for it. I'm absolutely all for it. So, and you know, anything that's opening up the political system, that's democratizing America, let's make it happen. Bring it on. Let's have more of it, because you know we and frankly, what brings that about is people like you, Gordon, getting out there, getting active. The earlier caller from Occupy Santa Barbara showing up.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's all about tag, you're it at the end of the day. It really is. We'll be back with more of the news of the day and your thoughts and my thoughts right after this Tri-7 Plus Day. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio TV program. 34 minutes past the hour, and wow. With apologies to Pastor Niemöller, who famously wrote after he'd been arrested by the Nazis, you know, first they came for the trade unionists, and from memory, I think I have this right, but close enough, anyhow. First they came for the trade unionists. I was not a trade unionist, so I did not speak up. But then they came for the communists, and I was not a communist, and so I did not speak up. And then they came for the Jews, and I was not a Jew, and I did not speak up. And you know, he goes through a couple, and then they came for the churchmen, and there was no one left to speak for me. Well, with apologies to Pastor Niemöller, Rick Perry
in Virginia. Virginia has said to the Republican Party, you have to use the same restrictive voter ID rules for your party primary that we're going to impose on everybody during the general election. And as a result, Newt Gingrich got thrown off the ballot. And he says, this is a broken system. Well, yeah, of course, that's my point. And Rick Perry got thrown off the ballot. And Rick Perry is going, I need a lawyer. So with apologies to Pastor Niemöller, first they didn't let the African-Americans vote. But Rick Perry was not an African-American, so he didn't speak up. Then they didn't let the Latinos vote. Rick Perry was not a Latino, so he did not speak up. Then they didn't let the students vote. Rick Perry wasn't a student, so he didn't speak up. Then they didn't let the poor people vote, and Rick Perry wasn't a poor person, so he didn't speak up. And then they didn't let the Democrats in Washington, D.C. have representation, or anybody in D.C. for that matter. Rick Perry didn't live in D.C., so he didn't speak up. And then they didn't let Newt Gingrich on the ballot, and Rick Perry hated Newt Gingrich, so he didn't speak up. But then they didn't let Rick Perry on the ballot in Virginia, and so he called a lawyer. Rick Perry, isn't it ironic, Rick Perry from the state where they, one of the few states where they actually have, quote, tort reform? If a doctor screws you up and damages your child for the rest of his or her life, the most you can sue for is $250,000 in Texas. And they said, this is going to lower the cost of medical care in Texas. It's going to dramatically cut the cost of that malpractice insurance that those doctors have to pay that's putting them out of business. And it made no difference. Cost of medical care in Texas, same as every place else. But trial lawyers don't make as much money in Texas. And trial lawyers tend to go with the Democrats because they're all about liberty and protecting the little guy. Anyway, 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. Ron in Portland. Hey, Ron, what's on your mind today?
Hey, you were talking earlier about the thing about TSA, and I am mystified as to why, when we're always looking for places to cut the budget and cut this, and everybody's screaming about the TSA at the same time. Yeah. One of the reasons Congress has the power to purse strings is so that they can preserve our freedoms. And why don't they just say, if you can't figure out a way to do this and keep our Constitution protections and liberties in place, we're not going to fund you.
Yeah, there was...
And I think they would straighten out in very remarkably short time.
There was motion in that direction a couple of years ago where it wasn't like do away with the TSA, but, you know, hey, let's dial back on this a little bit. Let's let people wear their shoes, you know, stop all these. You know, there's an epidemic of athlete's foot going on in airports all over the country right now. Nobody likes to talk about it. But, you know, people, it's one of the more common complaints that I hear and, you know, read on message boards. You know, I bring up this topic, the TSA people say, I got athlete's foot when I went through the airport this year. Anyhow, so there's, you know, so there, why don't you let people keep their shoes on and things like that? And the TSA, you know, there was a kind of a consensus. It's time to dial it back, guys. We don't need to be afraid anymore. We overreacted after 9/11. We all got hysterical. George Bush was pumping the fear up. You had Tom Ridge out there who later confessed in his book and on TV that the Bush administration was telling him to jack up the terror alerts every time John Kerry got a little bit of good press during the 2004 election. And you know, so you know, terror was being used by Republican politicians against Americans as a political tool, which in my world makes them terrorists. But in any case, that all came to a screeching halt when money got into the equation. When Michael Chertoff left the head of the Homeland Security, which runs TSA, and became the head lobbyist for one of the companies that sells these X-ray porno scanners, suddenly there was money to be made in wanding people. There was money to be made. It wasn't just those old metal scanners anymore. Now we're talking multi-million-dollar devices.
So the question still is, why don't the – I mean, I'm sure there's enough Republicans. I mean, some of the – that.
Let me connect the dots for you, Ron. Let me connect the dots for you. When there's money to be made in something, somebody makes money. Those people make that money, and what do they do with that money? They give some of it to politicians. What do the politicians do? They say, okay, let's do more of this that makes more money for these people so they'll give us more donations. And all of this you can thank the Supreme Court for because they set up the system.
And so once Chertoff was able to make millions with his TSA porno scanners, suddenly there is a lobbying group here in Washington, D.C., that just lobbies for things like airport security. And they want it. And now this is why they're taking this train, this thing on the road to trains and buses and random stops and now they want to take it to malls, right? They call them soft targets. There was an article yesterday, I think it was in the Washington Post, about how, the TSA wants to go to soft targets. We're going to start looking at, it's a money making thing, Ron, and that's the bottom line. And you and me need to stand up and we need to say to our politicians, enough already. We're not scared. We don't need to be a nation of cowards. This is the land of the free and the home of the brave. Don't you get it? But they're not gonna do this. They're not gonna do it. Marie in Portland. Hey Marie, what's up?
Hi Tom. I just wanted to tell you a story that my daughter is in high school here in Portland, and she's working at one of the concession stands in the airport after school. Mm-hmm. And the other day, well, a couple of weeks ago, they called me from school because she hadn't come in to class. Excuse me. And so I went to the airport to pick her up because I wanted to go back to school.
Right.
And she doesn't get wanded when she goes to work, by the way. She just walks in the side door and goes in. Nobody checks her or anything, but they wouldn't let me in. I was a mother trying to get my kid to go back to school. They wouldn't let me in. They wouldn't let me call. They wouldn't let me do anything, and they turned me away. I wanted my child to go back to high school where she belonged.
Because you didn't have an airplane ticket.
No, she works in Wendy. At a concession stand.
Yes.
In the airport.
Okay.
And,
got it.
So she cut school and went to work instead, and I went to the airport to get her, and they wouldn't let me in.
That's amazing.
She, by the way, doesn't get wanded when she goes into work.
Yeah. No, and it's like it, Marie, you are, thank you for the call. You are confirming my assertion that this is security theater. It is just theater. It is just a dance, pure and simple. Julie in Sacramento. Hey, Julie, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I'm calling because I am a veteran. I am a Vietnam era veteran, and my husband was a Vietnam veteran. And I am a 16-year survivor and veteran of his war zone violence brought home.
Yeah, this is apropos of what I was saying at the end of the last hour, was it? Or was it the last segment where I was talking about the end of the last hour where the war comes home and it's these horrific crimes and in many cases crimes against themselves. And, one Iraq war vet who waterboarded his 7-year-old foster child. That, back during the Vietnam War, we used to say the war comes home. And people don't realize that when George Bush decided to invade two countries, he was inflicting violence on his own country.
He was. And the one thing that I wanted to say was that it took me decades to understand what had happened to my husband, because he was the happy-go-lucky lover, not a fighter, and those were his words. Mm-hmm. And when he came back, he was totally, his eyes were just vacant. And it took me decades, and it wasn't until I heard Dan Edge speaking of his documentary that he had released last May, mm-hmm. Before Memorial Day, and that was Wounded Platoon. And as I sat and listened to him, I realized that he kept saying that the war zone affects very few of our troops. And I said, you lie. And I had to call and talk to him. Yeah. But as I listened to him, I realized that the war zone strips the body, mind, heart, soul, and spirit of the innocent.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it turns legal, moral, and ethical behavior and laws that we learn inside out and upside down. And it's like losing your sexual innocence.
Yeah. Well, it's like the first thing you learn is thou shalt not kill. And, yeah. I mean, it is the fundamental law of humanity. And then they say, oh, by the way, we're going to teach you to kill, and we're going to send you off, and we're going to have you kill a bunch of people. And then come back to society and pretend like everything's cool.
But the brain, it's the brain that does it. It that records everything in flashbacks, and that's how my husband ended up attacking me 5 times. I survived 3 of them by a heartbeat.
Oh my.
I am barely alive, Tom. I just, the PTSD has gotten so bad. So his PTSD became my PTSD.
Right.
And
right.
I was terrified of his flashbacks because I never knew if he was going to go from one end to the other. The only problem was that he had flashbacks that were mental and physical.
Right.
And when I watched him, it was like watching an old-time movie without words, without anything. He was going through the motions, but in his brain, he was going through what he was doing in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And I can...
Yeah. And
thank you so much.
Thank you, Julie, for calling. I'm very sorry to hear your story, but thank you for calling and sharing your story with our listeners, Julie. I wish you the very, very best. And there's really two sides to this, by the way. One is the wounded warriors who come back. And the other is that there's a lot of warriors who come back looking for a job, and people are afraid to hire them because of those wounds.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And we need to be encouraging, A, employers to hire them, put them back to work, and B, a healing process with our Veterans Administration. Talk media for the rest of us. Tom Hartman here, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Victoria Jones, also here in D.C. with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria, what's going on in the world today?
Well, the U.S. said to Iran today, no, it will not tolerate any kind of disruption of naval traffic through the Strait of Hormuz. This is the second day that Iran has threatened that it's capable of closing the vital oil route if the West imposes any new sanctions targeting Tehran's oil exports. Today it was Iran's Navy chief saying it's very easy for his country's naval forces to close the Strait of Hormuz.
Well, it is. One side of the Strait of Hormuz is Iran, is it not?
I believe so.
Yeah, so
yeah, it would be easy. They say that they've got a combination of all kinds of warships, submarines, speedboats, and other things that they could do it.
Yeah, it would be like, you know, Michigan or Ohio saying we're gonna close the connection between Lake Erie and Lake Michigan. I mean, they're right there. So,
yeah.
So the United States? They're saying if you guys prevent us from selling oil, if you expand the sanctions against us, this is how we're gonna respond. Are we continuing to suggest, did we ever suggest in the first place that we were expand the sanctions, that we were going to expand the sanctions? And if so, have we backed down from that? Are we continuing to do that? Where is the administration at on this?
Well, Western nations are getting very impatient with Iran over its nuclear program with that recent IAEA report, and have accused Iran, obviously, of using its nuclear program as a cover to develop nuclear weapons.
Right.
And the Congress, the U.S. Congress, has just passed a bill banning dealings with the Iran Central Bank, which President Obama is going to sign despite his misgivings. And the reason that the administration has misgivings is that they say that it could impose hardships on U.S. allies, and it could drive up oil prices. And the Congress basically has said, we don't care about that. We want to ban dealings with Iran's central bank anyway.
Yeah,
so
these are the saber rattlers. What I don't get is Pakistan already has nukes. Israel has nukes. If Iran gets nukes, that just means that we can't do to them what we did to Iraq. And that, George Bush said there's this axis of evil, right? Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. Kim Jong-il got nukes really, really quick, and
right.
George Bush backed off. The Iranians have to be looking at that going, what, are we stupid? Of course we're going to get a nuke. And there's I don't know how many countries in the world have nukes, but there's a bunch of them right now.
There's a lot of countries that have nukes. One of the concerns is that it could be a game changer in the Middle East, and that you would then see other countries in the Middle East saying, well, if Iran has nukes, then we're going to have nukes too.
Yeah, but they're all in such a tight area. If any of them try to use nukes against each other, they're basically committing suicide.
Indeed.
So, you know, I personally, I'm not hysterical about this, but I understand that Fox has been, you know, probably really ginning this up, and the right wing and the Republicans, you know, they've got a new thing that everybody can be afraid of. And the president doesn't want to seem like he's not on the fear side or something. I don't know, but man, this is playing with fire.
It's something that certainly the U.S. is being very very strong about. I mean, certainly the president has always said no option is off the table. right. even though the Republican presidential candidates have accused him of being soft on Iran, Leon Panetta on 60 Minutes saying again, no option is off the table.
Yeah.
That statement was made to sound as though it was news. Actually, it wasn't news. It's been administration policy for a very long time.
He has to realize, I mean, here, you have a president who has arrested and deported more illegal aliens, to use the right-wing phrase, than any other president in the history of the United States, and yet the Republican candidates still go in every debate and go, oh, this president's soft on illegal immigration. He wants to, you know. And actually, the guy who thinks that there shouldn't be a border between the U.S. and Mexico is Ron Paul. But that's a whole other argument. You know, the libertarians think that all borders should be wide open. But this president does that, and they still lie about him. Why does he think that he has to pander to their right-wing fear when they're going to lie about it anyway?
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, I'm sorry. It was a rhetorical question. You're a reporter. I'm a commentator, ranter. So we'll stay to those roles, as you've done so well. Thank you, Victoria. So what else is going on?
Well, meantime, in Cairo, Egypt, the trial of Hosni Mubarak, former dictator, resumed today after a three-month break, with the Egyptian leader who's been ousted returning to the cage on a gurney. Covered by a green blanket, he spoke once to say he was present, which he was, and the session lasted a few hours. And the defense lawyers had a number of requests approved, which by the judge, who, by the way, prosecutors and actually human rights activists are trying to have ousted because they think that he's sympathetic to the defense. But these are requests that seem to be part of a strategy to show that the protesters were not killed by security forces, but by assailants working for a foreign nation or criminals impersonating police officers, which would really go to a meme that is very common in Egypt, which is that any time there's an uprising, it has to do with foreigners. But
right.
Very interestingly, an administrative court yesterday ruled that the Egyptian military had wrongly violated the human rights of female demonstrators by subjecting them to virginity tests intended to humiliate them. This is huge. It was the first decision to address this scandal arising from one of the military's first crackdowns on protesters on March the 9th. And it was the first time since the military takeover that a civilian court has tried to exert any kind of judicial authority over the ruling generals. And the military council's often denied imposing these virginity tests, but the court said it relied in part on an Amnesty International report, and it said that it did happen. And the defense that they were protecting against potential charges of rape was no justification. It said it did happen and that it was a deliberate humiliation and intentional insult to women.
Could this be the beginning of the end of the grip of power of the military in Egypt?
It's a tiny bit. It's a tiny slide.
Yeah. Okay. Step by step. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by the new book, Self-Empowerment. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So is SOPA the end of us? No, I'm not talking about that stuff you lather yourself with. The Stop Internet Piracy Act, or Stop Online Piracy Act, and Protect IP Act, PIPA and SOPA. Deanna Zant is with us. She's a media technologist, strategist, and author of Share This: How You Will Change the World with Social Networking. Website, Deanna, D-E-A-N-N-A, Zant, Z-A-N-D-T.com. Deanna, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. First of all, the highest profile, basically kind of news I've seen about this is Ron Wyden trying to stop at least the Protect IP side on the Senate, and being treated by some in the media as kind of a Don Quixote figure. But You know, I think he's right. I mean, I was horrified when he came out the other day and joined with Paul Ryan on Medicare, but on this issue, he's spot on. On the other hand, you know, there's some big people with him, behind him, or associated with trying to stop the the Protect IP Act. People like Google, big bucks, giant corporations, giant multi-billion-dollar transnational corporations. So lay out for us the landscape. What the hell's going on here?
Well, it's interesting that you bring up the kind of the phrase uncanny or something bedfellows.
Unholy alliances, strange bedfellows.
Well, you know, I think this is actually some place where people on the left and right actually can find some common ground, because everybody agrees that things like censorship are a bad idea, privacy, things like that are important. So what's happening with SOPA is, it stands for the Stop Online Piracy Act, and it's a bill that's moving through the House right now that is, in effect, going to broaden the powers of the Department of Justice and copyright holders to do terrible things to people who violate copyrights. And that can be anything from somebody using a song in their homemade YouTube video that they made for their friends, up to streaming movies and television illegally from services outside of the U.S. and all kinds of stuff.
Right.
And that's actually the problem that most people have with this bill, is that the language of the bill is so unbelievably broad that it can be pretty easily abused right away from any number of sources. And what we're most worried about is that it really does threaten the actual architecture of how the Internet works now. Right now, the Internet itself as a technology isn't aware of content. This is the same argument that we have with net neutrality issues. It isn't aware of what that content is. All it knows is these are some bits and bytes, and we're passing them along. And this would, in effect, do is start regulating what content is okay to be passed through these pipes and what content is not okay. And that could deal a crippling blow to the Internet.
Well, isn't there already a certain amount of that in that there are laws against child porn, for example? And I was over the weekend, my son was telling me that I've noticed here in D.C. that while I pay one of the big providers I buy 5 MIPS, 5 megabytes per second of download time, they always throttle it at 2 whenever Louise goes to Netflix. And I mean, she was before our flight, she was from iTunes, she was trying to download a movie, and it wouldn't let it go faster than 2, even though we're paying for 5. And I was discussing it with my son, and he said, well, that's because they've got to do deep packet inspection because they're looking for child porn. And I said, I think that's their excuse. What they're really trying to do is restrict bandwidth so that they can make more money.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you.
But they have that law. Do they not?
They actually, and also as far as, the whole piracy argument to this, this is actually what the main argument is for people who are proponents of this bill, is to stop online piracy, on online theft of content.
Right.
And the problem with piracy is it's sort of like whack-a-mole. You know, you're always going to be kind of smacking down one thing or another that's cropping up, and you're never actually going to be able to stop it in the way that we're thinking about it right now. And the rest of us are ending up being kind of casualties in this war and what we're allowed to do and not do.
Let's talk a real-life example here. For example, at TomHartman.com, I post a blog. I write my stuff. I mean, it's original content.
Mm-hmm.
However, people can comment on those things, and people can create their own blogs, or they can create their own messages. So if somebody comes onto my website and they comment on something that I said, or they create, an original thread, and they quote something that's copyrighted,
right?
Who does the FBI come after? Me, right?
Likely you, yes.
Yeah, because it's my website. And now, on the other hand, if I was to say, okay, screw this, I'm going to move to Finland and do my radio show from there and run my website from there, then the FBI couldn't come after me because somebody posted some copyrighted content, even though anybody in the United States, it would look like it was the exact same website.
Right.
How does this make any sense?
This is where the Internet is blurring kind of national boundaries that in many ways in many ways don't make sense anymore, but that are hard to create rules and jurisdictions for. And on top of that, that argument that you're making right now about moving to another country is actually the argument that big businesses and venture capitalists are actually making from the pro-business end of the spectrum, is that a lot of people have said, well, we'll just move out of the U.S. and do our own thing.
Right. So really Google moves to Taiwan or something.
Yeah, you never know. If those kinds of rules come down and make it impossible for technologists to continue to innovate and create these amazing services. And for the everyday user, too, I mean, one of the examples that I've been using when I've been explaining this issues in lectures and workshops is that it... if you're on Facebook and people have been posting a lot of those kind of funny images, and sometimes they have celebrities and they have text and stuff, or they have a picture of the Enterprise from Star Trek or something amusing like that. That
with a thought balloon next to the person saying something silly.
Yeah. And they're hilarious and everybody loves them, except for the fact that now would be illegal to share or to create.
And for that matter, if somebody posted on my website or any on Facebook, any other website, posted some copyrighted information, and you downloaded it and stored it on your hard drive,
yes,
then the FBI could come after you, too.
It could very well be. And the interesting
thing, so it turns us into a nation of criminals by accident.
Right. And we have also already in place a certain amount of copyright protection in the U.S. There is the Digital Copyright Millennium Act, which isn't perfect and is still kind of infuriating in a lot of ways, but you'll see sometimes on YouTube, for example, somebody posts a video with a song and they don't have permission to use that song. They'll see this video has been taken down because of the DCMA. And, there's already stuff in place that is largely also very imperfect and doesn't work right.
So this is a solution without a problem.
Yeah, well, it's also, we're thinking about content online, and not to get too metaphorical, but we're thinking about content online in a way that is still very much rooted in the industrial way of producing and marketing and selling things. And digital content just doesn't operate this way. And we have to rethink what we consider intellectual property and the value of collaboration and sharing and remixing is unbelievable. I mean, those cultures are creating an incredible amount of good stuff, and especially, this also applies to political activists and all kinds of stuff.
Thomas Jefferson, when he was in 1787, and when Madison, his protege, was writing the Constitution, he wrote a long letter to him saying there should be no copyright laws, there should be no trademarks. He called them monopolies in commerce. There should be none, and it should be one of the Bill of Rights. He wanted it in the Bill of Rights. Because he said, every man who creates something stands on the shoulders of a man before him, the phrase of the day, women before as well, who created something else. Everything is derivative. Anyhow, Deanna Zant, deannazant.com. Thank you, Deanna.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is an amazing story that is not going to go away, and you need to contact your member of Congress and say, no, thank you to this SOPA thing. Twenty minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, and I will be getting back to your calls in just a moment. But first, I just want to take a few moments of your time here through this last week of the year, the last week for tax deductible contributions. And remind you about the Salem Children's Village and the Hunter School in New Hampshire, in Rumney, New Hampshire. Salem Children's Village, a community for abused kids, Hunter School, a program for children who are severely challenged. We call them energetically sensitive kids, severely challenged by things like Asperger's syndrome, attention deficit hyperactive disorder, and that whole spectrum of quote disorders. And in fact, one of the first things that we tell these kids is that you're not broken. You're not disordered. It's one of the really unique things about Hunter School. In fact, the name Hunter School. And by the way, this is because I only have a couple minutes here. Let me interrupt myself and say this is a fundraiser and we're asking people to make donations to Hunter. Go to hunterschool.org. You can read all about it there, but there's a donate button. And with a $250 contribution, you get a copy, an autographed copy of the Tom Hartman Reader, my most recent book. And with a $1,000 contribution, We will let you sit in the, we'll bring you to our TV studio. You can stand in the control room, watch us do the TV show, and I'll take you, and Louise and I will take you out to dinner on our nickel here in Washington, D.C. You just have to make it to D.C. sometime in the year 2012, and we'll try to work our schedule, you know, with yours. So, anyway, the Hutter School has the name Hutter School because back 20 some odd years ago, when a member of my family was diagnosed with attention deficit disorder and told horrible things about, you know, how he was going to be, you know, disabled or probably a criminal or whatever, you know, all the awful stories that people hear, it occurred to me that these characteristics of ADD actually would be very, very useful in a hunting-gathering society, constantly distractible, scanning your environment, noticing what's going on around you. For a hunter-gatherer, that helps you find food, right? Impulsivity, making quick decisions. Of course, you know, if you're chasing a rabbit through the forest, a deer goes by, you can't pull out a pad and pen and say, let's do a risk-benefit analysis. You have to make an instant decision. And a desire for high levels of stimulation, that's a perfect thing for a hunter, you know, a hunting-gathering person. But it's a lousy thing for a farmer. And so when agriculture came along, and then, of course, it's paralleled the industrialization of America or of the world, and so, you know, put the screw on this bolt all day long. The farmers kind of took over. And our schools are set up for the farmers, not the hunters. And so we said, hey, you're just a hunter in a farmer's world. The farmers took over. You're wired, brain wiring is that of a hunter-gatherer. And you can be successful doing that, and we'll show you how. And there's a different way of teaching hunter kids than there is farmer kids. And they do the farmer's kids just fine in the public schools, most private schools. We do the hunter kids, thus hunter school, hunter in a farmer's world. And then we expanded to include Asperger's and other conditions associated with that. And as we're seeing more and more of these kids coming into the system, and kids with severe rage disorders and behavioral problems and things like that, that really, in my opinion, are wounds. I mean, kids who have just been so wounded by a system that doesn't understand them, that doesn't get them, that doesn't teach them, that doesn't work to them. And so we're trying to raise money for the Hunter School, in part to help, you know, build the school, improve the school, all that kind of thing. And also because we have a summer program that there's a lot of kids really need. Their families just can't handle them. They're not in their regular school. And so we want to offer some scholarships to kids for our summer program next summer. And that's, you know, part of your contribution will go toward that for scholarships for kids in the summer when the school districts don't pay for placements or, you know, when people are not. So that's the program. And the program, that's a 6-week residential camp that we're talking about. The program, the Hunter School, we teach peace, nonviolence. So much so that since this program was started in 1978, and the program that it's based on in Germany, which was started in the 1950s, are vegetarian. I mean, we're absolutely nonviolent. We're approved by the State of New Hampshire's Department of Education. Here's a letter from one of the parents. My son has been struggling for years. He has been diagnosed with Asperger's and ADHD, which have been extremely challenging for him and the whole family. He's been suspended out district multiple times and recently was hospitalized because he just couldn't handle things anymore. He is only 9 years old. We've tried all avenues, mainstream as well as alternative approaches. He's been through countless evaluations, counselors, psychiatrists, psychologists, medications, homeopathic therapies, acupuncture, and many more with no success. Desperate and faced with the recommendation of a residential program for our child, we researched and found the Hunter School. Through the Hunter School, we were introduced to this work. We as a family have always practiced meditation, Reiki, and energy work, but have never found anything like this. In just one short month of working with us and our child, we have been given our son back. When he started working with Michael's doing some workshops, by the way, coming up. You can, in Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., Plymouth, New Hampshire, and Saratoga Springs, New York, you can find the information at Hunter School's website, hunterschool.org. He said, in just one short month of working with Michael, with our child, he had extreme, when he started working with Michael, they're talking about their son, he had extreme outbursts, was negative, depressed, and never showed any type of emotion, not even a smile. In the past month, he's going to school every day. He's happy, and the past weekend that we spent with him, he was smiling and showing real and appropriate emotion.
As a mother who has not seen this in her son for 6 years, it is huge. We are very grateful to the Hunter School for providing this critical piece to the success of the children who attend. Thank you for giving us our son back. So from kids who are suffering very, very serious challenges in a world that doesn't understand how they are energetically challenged, doesn't understand how their minds work, doesn't understand the genius that's inside them, to kids who in some cases, parents have no resources. We still have, some kids who are, quote, failed adoptions, kids who have been through several homes, and, you know, ultimately no parent will take them. And the state ends up placing them with us. You can help. HunterSchool.org. Your donations. $250 for a book, $1,000 for dinner.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And any amount, $10, $25, $50, any amount helps a lot. HunterSchool.org. Thank you. That's the good, the bad, and the very, very barotrustly ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The good, the 99% choir, an offshoot of the Occupy Wall Street movement, descended upon Bank of America's Seattle headquarters to sing Christmas carols and foreclosure on the bank. Some of the modified lyrics sung by the 99% choir include, "Deck the jails with Wall Street banksters," and "You deserve jail, not bonuses," fa-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. Eventually, the 98% choir was escorted out of the bank, but not before their message was heard loud and clear by the banksters inside. Good work. The bad, Rick Perry. At a campaign stop in Iowa, Perry weighed in on energy policy and ongoing tensions with Iran. Perry told the audience, "We need to stop buying oil from foreign sources and instead buy oil from places like Canada." Perry said, "Every barrel of oil that comes out of those sands in Canada is a barrel of oil we don't have to buy from a foreign source." Perry went on to say that buying energy from foreign sources is, quote, "not good policy, it's not good politics, and frankly, it's un-American," end quote. First, will someone please tell Rick that Canada is a foreign country, not a territory of the United States? And second, tar sands oil from Canada is one of the most toxic forms of oil that can be produced. It won't solve our energy problems. It will destroy our environment. Then again, the Texas oil barons who are funding Rick Perry's campaign don't really care about the environment. And the very, very ugly Peter Johnson Jr. Since it's one of the slowest news weeks of the year, GOP TV's second-rate talking head Peter Johnson Jr. dusted off the old talking points and bashed the Occupy Wall Street movement yesterday. Referring to the Occupy Iowa caucus's plan to disrupt next week's caucus, Johnson said,
"The circus has come to town. We've had hobos. We've had tramps. We've had bums. We've had hippies. We've had yippies. Perhaps we'll look back on this in a nostalgic way and say, isn't this wonderful? All these misguided people with nothing to do in January, they showed up in Iowa. They didn't make a difference."
Right. Saying the Occupy movement hasn't made a difference just proves that the talking heads of GOP TV do live in a bubble. Millions across the world have turned out as part of the movement. And the dialogue in America has shifted away from debt reduction and toward job creation. And even Republicans now are talking about wealth inequality for the first time. But since the movement is a threat to corporate media like Fox so-called News, then the talking heads over there need to keep ridiculing it. And that's very, very ugly. Michelle Bachmann said that she would never use a teleprompter. You know, this is part of her hit on Obama, is that he reads from a teleprompter really well. So she says, "I'm never going to use a teleprompter." So she's out there using an iPad. She's looking down at her iPad. Oh, man. There's some funny stuff. I got to tell you about Intrade. Intrade is now saying that Romney's probability of being the Republican presidential nominee is 74%. Intrade.com is the Irish betting site, and they're usually pretty spot on. So it's like, you know, the rest of it's just circus.
866-987-THOM, our telephone number, Joe in Springville, Utah. Hey, Joe, thanks for listening on Sirius. What's up?
Oh, Tom, you're a godsend. I've been listening to you since you first came on, and I want to just couple onto this, that what you give as an example for the rest of us to do, and it's helped me a lot, is to move forward, educate yourself, learn, talk to other people. And it's brought me to this point that all of the issues we face are two things, systemic or specific. The specific being healthcare, education, so on and so forth. But the systemic issue, until it's resolved, we won't be able to fix the other one. And that is, we need constitutional literacy within the next 10 years in this country.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Promoting this. Well, it comes, I've been handing them out, and I've been doing it. I'm a truck driver, and I've been focusing on the Constitution, and people will say things. I'll hand them a Constitution, ask them to show it to me, and like states' rights. And I said, there's no states' rights. There's powers that are given to the state. But that states' rights issue is in the first three words, we the people. They argued about that, and they lost.
Yeah.
It's we the people, not we the state.
Right.
For one example.
Yeah.
And a lot of this I learned from listening to you and you focusing on it. And I try to give credit to wherever I found it from, because I want people to understand that I'm with this on the copyright law bull crap too, is we stand on the shoulders of so many other people whenever we're talking about something or doing something, whatever we're doing, it came from somewhere else.
Yep.
So,
Jefferson.
Anyway.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, Jefferson, Louise and I went to Monticello a couple of weekends ago. And for the first time in my life, and it was an amazing experience. But Jefferson invented hundreds of inventions, including a copy machine, an early copy machine, which he used to make his letters, where he had a pen and it had another pen on an arm, and it made a copy. But in any case, he never patented any of them, because he felt that everything was based on somebody else making the thing before it. And he was willing, as president, he was willing to go along with a copyright law or a trademark law that lasted for 3 years. Let the guy benefit for a couple of years, but then throw it out to the people, make it available. And as an author, I get money for the books that I write, right? And so the copyright law benefits me. But I would be the first to say, at the end of 3 years, make it public, make it the public domain. I agree with Jefferson. Or right from the get-go,
yeah.
I think that people would give credit to actual authors, and they'd say, I want the original copy actually from that person. I think
Go ahead. I think one of the big problems that it creates for us is this idea of, it's my money, and I ask people to show me your money. And when they show it to me, I say, well, that doesn't have your name on it. What are you talking about? Came from the commons. We created that for everyone to have, not for handful to have, and you don't get to take it with you. And why would you? You're going to use it if it's there for everybody to use. And the whole idea, one fellow said to me, I can't remember the name of the person, but let's say Marconi. He was pointing at when I was talking about how there's nothing that we have today that wasn't built off the shoulders of millions of other people before us.
Yep.
And so he used this guy. I said, really? Well, take Marconi and put him back in the 15th century, and how relevant is he?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Or put Einstein into the 12th century. You got nothing.
Yeah.
Everything builds on something else. Very, very well said. Joe, thank you for your kind words, and thanks for calling, and thanks for listening. Robert in Washington, D.C. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Listen, first of all, I want to say one of the most inspirational documentaries I have ever seen is I Am.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, Tom Shadyac did a brilliant job with that movie, and I was really honored to be one of the stars of it, I guess, one of the people in it. And I think you can probably rent it now, and it's because it's not in the theaters anymore. It's a brilliant documentary. I agree.
What I would love to do is to get one of the local D.C. churches to do a viewing of that somehow.
Well, you should contact Tom. I think the information, I think his contact information is on his website.
Yeah, because I think for the Occupy movement, everything in that movie applies to the organic rise of the Occupy movement.
Yep.
And just some news, January 17th, just an organic happening The first I heard of it was from the live stream in Berkeley. Mm-hmm. People are talking about coming to D.C. for January 17th to celebrate the four-month anniversary of Occupy Wall Street and the return of Congress members.
Oh, interesting. Well, that's great. And if people stick around for another 3 days on January 20th, I'll be on the steps of the Supreme Court. We're going to occupy the Supreme Court. And
right,
or at least, you know, at noon, I'll be there at noon. There's going to be a whole bunch of other people throughout the day. And so, Robert, thanks for the heads up. Thank you for the kind words. And, you know, keep it going. OK.
And thank you.
Thank you very much. David in Seattle listening on AM 1090. Hey, David, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I'm a big fan. I really loved your special the other day talking about Bill Hicks. It got me thinking about his marketing skit. And I started thinking about this whole thing about our laws being written by lobbyists. It looked like cell phone contracts these days, all the terms and conditions.
You're right.
And then I started thinking about how things are so much different than back in the days of slavery. Things were tangible. Racism was out in front of your face. It was no hiding it. Today, everything's subversive. Yeah. So in my view, the way things are transitioning in our economy, the 20th Amendment that we need is today's version of the 14th Amendment. You have bankers extracting wealth, and I'm way a lot less than three-fifths of a person of BP, if they're a person. So they've greatly disproportioned that greater than three-fifths than back in the day, because BP is a person with no citizenship requirements, and the currency allows them access as citizenship.
Did you hear what Brazil is doing?
No.
Brazil, it wasn't BP in this case. It was, I believe it was Chevron. But it was also Transocean, which is, you know, who owned the oil rig that blew up where those 11 men died in the Gulf. Transocean and I'm pretty sure it was Chevron, had a big oil spill in off the coast of Brazil. And the Brazilian federal police are targeting 17 executives in these country in these two companies for individual criminal prosecution.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, this is more of a threat to us than any illegal alien type of issue. Yeah. If we could position this to all the Tea Party framers that are concerned about subversion and nationalism, be peace trading with Iran as we speak.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. And all kinds of transnational corporations. And for that matter, Halliburton was trading with Iran when Dick Cheney was running it, and it was illegal to trade with Iran here in the United States.
Their own privacy. They're controlling our free speech by controlling our wages.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a piece of it. Absolutely. David, thank you very much. Good to hear from you. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
74.2% odds that Mitt Romney will be the Republican nominee over at M-Trade. Well, get ready, folks.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Greg in Los Angeles, you have you are an advocate of SOPA?
I didn't catch the SOPA stuff. I'm a composer. I'm
okay.
A music composer in Los Angeles, and I'm a BMI member, and my friends and I, you know, BMI ASCAP people, we look at that as a basically as a pension or retirement. You know, the more you build up your royalties, especially if you're composing on TV,
sure,
then networks get to exploit that, and you share in the exploitation.
So you're pushing back on my comment that copyrights and trademarks should only last 3 years. How about this as an alternative? Let's say that trademarks last for the lifetime of the creator because it's art, and copyrights last for the lifetime of the creator, and patents. Copyrights and trademarks last for the lifetime of the creator. Patents last for 3 years.
Right. I hadn't thought in that direction. I was really just calling to talk about copyrights.
Yeah. Okay. Well, with regard to copyrights, what has happened is because of the mouse, in large part, you know, Disney argued really strongly for this when Mickey Mouse was going to go out of copyright and into the public domain, and Walt Disney was long dead, but the corporation wasn't, and the corporation was like, well, we want to continue to be able to make money off the mouse and every other product there. And to me, that seems like it stifles innovation and creativity. It seems to me that, you know, when a person dies, that that should be
at some point it should enter public domain, absolutely.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, when I look at YouTube and I see them selling banner ads on top of EMI videos, there are 8,000 videos from EMI on YouTube. And I really doubt that the songwriters are getting the royalties, but I believe EMI is getting some of the royalties. Or when I see people selling banner ads on lyric sites for music, you know, and you can check out any music lyric you want, and then there are banner ads being sold on that.
Right.
You know, that's exploitation.
Well, those are violations of existing copyright laws, Greg.
Right.
I mean,
not the EMI videos with YouTube.
EMI is the licensing agency.
And either way, YouTube isn't, you know, it's DMCA. Your guest was saying DCMA.
Yeah.
The DMCA provides safe harbor.
Right.
So that if you post on YouTube, the copyright owner has to give a takedown notice.
Well, the topic, I think maybe you tuned in late. Did you hear Deanna's aunt at the beginning of the hour?
I didn't. My iPhone was going in.
Okay. The topic was, you know, there's this new legislation that's been produced. It's the Protect IP Act in the Senate. It's SOPA in the House of Representatives. They both basically say the same thing, which is that if you own a website, Greg, and let's say you post your song to your website or a sample of it and you offer it for sale and you allow comments, and I comment on the song with a quote from Bob Dylan, you know, who's still alive and whose stuff isn't copyright. You then can be arrested and your website can be taken down because you're hosting copyrighted content.
Right, right.
And you can go to prison for 3 years.
I think that's a little radical.
I think it's a lot radical. Right. I think it's a lot radical. We do need to protect intellectual property. I'm with you on that as much as I'm probably far more radical than you, but I understand the need of artists to have control over their art, at least during their lifetimes. Greg, I got to move along, but thank you.
I would like to see the DMCA be rolled back a little bit. I think the DMCA was an overreach and that Silicon Valley just reached in and got their hands on the money pot, and we really don't get a shake.
I agree with you. Greg, thank you very much for the call. Bob in Oil City, Pennsylvania, you're a webmaster?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I own about 300 websites. Most of them are just domains without the website. But I came across something 3 or 4 years ago. I don't know if you've heard of this, but it's where there's programs out there where people can take someone's book or story or magazine article or what have you, kind of rough, and simply it'll automatically regenerate the content. And then they can call it their own simply by changing, say, adjectives or adverbs and things like that.
Oh, that's interesting. I never used this. It rewrites it enough that it complies with the copyright law?
And you can't. I could take your book and I could say change everywhere you said he. I could say.
Well, you'd have to change more than that. You'd have to change it substantially. It has to be a substantial rewrite. But in any case, so where were you going with this?
Rewrite that. My point was is that if they're going to try to protect people's books, I kind of disagree with you about the three things because it takes that long sometimes just to advertise a book or get it to be made popular.
I'm talking about patents. If you invent a new kind of solar cell, then I think that you should own the full rights to that for 3 years. But after that, but I guarantee you, if you invent a new solar cell, you did it based on technologies in part that hundreds of people before you invented. And so let's keep it moving forward. Let's only hold it for 3 years.
What about a 50% level decrease after the 3 years and then a 25% after 10?
I'm open to any kind of negotiation, but what it is right now is basically people lock things down for functionally forever, and it's stifling innovation. And I don't think it's good. I don't think it's a good thing. And I'm with Jefferson on this, although he was in his time kind of considered a Luddite, I suppose.
Yeah, I agree with you that everything's built upon people that rely on their livelihood for somebody who just writes books. I think it's a disgrace where you can have these people rewriting their articles with a machine. They don't do a thing. All they do is program.
Yeah. See, I'm not so worried about that because I think that if somebody's going to read a book that I wrote, they're not going to read it because of the inherent brilliance in it. They're going to read it because they know me, they know what I have to say, and they want to you know, I think that there's a connection to the author that's important. So I wouldn't be so worried about that, Bob. But thanks for your call. I get your point. Tomorrow, Senator Sanders is going to be with us. We're going to have a special early brunch with Bernie, our national town hall meeting with Senator Sanders. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.